Good afternoon. This is the 53rd episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida, and this is the 53rd episode. Today, we feature Paul Thompson, but before we get to Paul Thompson, I have to tell you a little bit about what's going on. And yes, I did complete my trifecta, the Morgantown Marathon, the Beach to Battle Triathlon, and the Marine Corps Marathon, all in a five-week span. And I'm kind of glad it's over, and I have a little break, I think 6 weeks to my next marathon. So it was great. I told you the last episode a little bit about Beach to Battle. The Marine Corps Marathon is one of my favorites. It's the one I've done the most time. This was my fourth time completing the Marine Corps Marathon. This time we did it with Runner's World Magazine, and so it's if you run marathons and you haven't done a Runner's World Magazine associated marathon, I would suggest you look it out. We arrived in Washington D.C. late Friday, and Saturday morning we got up and had a shakeout run about 3 miles with Bart Yasso. He is the chief running officer of Runner's World Magazine, along with some of his colleagues and about 40 or 50 other runners. We ran around the mall in D.C., you know, as the sun was coming up, the Washington Monument, and down the mall and up to the Lincoln Memorial, and actually had a group photo on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and then ran back. So that was, you know, a whole lot of fun. It was about 48 degrees and kind of got the bugs and the cobwebs out. We then took the metro to the expo, which was at the Conference Washington Convention Center. And those are always fun to walk around. And, of course, a couple hours later, you need food, right, if you're an endurance athlete, every 2 hour feedings. And we found a great sandwich shop. And I'm going to block on the name of it, but it was right there by the convention center. And we were able to get a great grilled vegetable sandwich and some polenta. So that held us for a while until we got back to the hotel. And a few hours later, I had some great Thai food. So that was our pre-race meal, was brown rice and Thai food. And no, I'm not afraid of spicy things. I found that when you eliminate dairy from your diet, you can tolerate spicy things before a marathon and they don't bother you at all. So we had some spicy Thai food, and then I think for dessert we had a hot chocolate Clif Bar. So that was a great way to end the evening. As most marathoners, you start watching the temperature and the weather forecast, and rain had been predicted on and off. So we went to the CVS pharmacy and bought rain gear so we would have it. And the morning of it said it would just be a few showers and they'd pass through, but we decided to bring our ponchos anyway. The best thing about doing a marathon with the Runner's World is they have their own tent. And again, if you're a marathon runner, your own tent, which was heated, which is cool, especially if it's 48 degrees outside, and your own set of porta-johns. So that means no line. So for runners, that's just about as good as you can get. So we huddled up in the Marine Corps Marathon tent where they had some coffee and bananas and got to mingle with all the other people running. There was a girl running that actually ended up setting the Guinness Book World of Records running as a hot dog. So, you know, different people run in fancy dress during marathons, and she did a great job. Then, you know, we moseyed up. It's interesting. You take the metro to the Pentagon, and you walk about a mile or so before you get into the Marathon Village. So we huddled there, and then you walk probably another half mile to up to the start line where everybody's lined up. There were over 30,000 runners. So as far in front of you and as far as behind you, you can see there are marathon runners. And the Marine Corps Marathon obviously is the nickname or their catchphrase is a marathon for the people, and it's run entirely by the Marine Corps. So at the start, the paratroopers from the Marines flew in or dropped in carrying giant American flags, which was just fantastic to see. And then there was a flyover by the Marines with their planes that the paratroopers jump out of. And the whole race is started by the firing of howitzer cannon. So that's how we get started. With 30,000 people, the course is packed. And, you know, this is my fourth time running it, and I have to say that it was more packed than it's ever been. People line up in their starting corrals, so you get to move. There wasn't any walking once we crossed the start line, but it's just a crowd of people running, and there's a crowd of people watching and spectating. It always amazes me the enthusiasm of spectators during a marathon. And of course, when we got down around, you know, along the mall again and where all the monuments were, people were sightseeing, but there were just throngs of people screaming. And the fact that people are so enthusiastic to cheer strangers on, you know, that of all shapes and sizes, clearly not going to be the race winners, but they're cheering just as hard as if they were leading the race and being chased, you know, by the second competitor. And it's just so inspiring. You can't help but, you know, pick up your pace a little bit when you're going by. And throngs of kids wanting to do high fives and people trying to pass out, you know, little pieces of candy or whatever they had besides the aid station. So it's just such an inspiring race. You know, it really makes you proud to live in America and be an American. You know, I know that may be a bit of a, you know, I don't know what kind of phrase, but it truly is an inspiring race. And, you know, the course goes along the Potomac with the fall colors and the monuments. We ran past the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial, the World War II Memorial, the Vietnam Memorial. And it's just, you know, it's just amazing sights and sounds to hear. You know, a lot of people run with headphones, and I never do. And I don't know why you would even consider in this race, because it's just so, there's just so much to see and hear. You know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing a back-to-back Ironman and marathon again. But, you know, I also wouldn't have changed the decision to do the Marine Corps Marathon again. And, you know, I'll look forward to doing it again if I get the opportunity. After the race, you know, the race finishes, you go up a big hill with people screaming to the Iwo Jima Memorial. And, you know, again, the Marines greet you at the top. And it's just a fantastic finish. Then we wandered out. There's this big, long line of finishers that wander out, and they give you a jacket, and they give you some food and water. And again, the Runner's World people had set up a reception for us at the Hyatt. So we walked in, and they said, "Are you ready for your massage?" And it's like, oh, cool. So they had a group of massage therapists in to give us a post-race stretch, which I have to say I've never done before, but if I ever have the opportunity to do it again, I will. That stretch was amazing. I didn't have hardly any quad stiffness the next day at all. Got a little niggle in my calf muscles, but my quads felt the best they ever have after a marathon, and especially 2 weeks after, you know, two marathons in 2 weeks, basically. So I would recommend anybody, if they can have somebody that knows what they're doing, to gently stretch them out after a marathon. It's fantastic. Then we had some food, and they had some plant-based food. They had, again, some veggie wraps that were really good with grilled vegetables. So we had our fill there and waited for the traffic to clear. And yes, we went and got some more of that Thai food at the same restaurant. There was a fantastic ginger miso soup with mushroom dumplings that, boy, it really hit the spot after the marathon. And then the next morning we went down and walked around a little bit more and went to the White House. The funniest part was we got lost, and there was a lady on the street asked us what we were looking for. It's like, could you direct us to the White House? It just kind of struck me as funny asking directions to the White House. But yeah, we had a really good time. So now I'm back and, you know, getting ready to ramp it up again for a marathon in December. We'll start out slow and do a little biking and swimming beforehand and then go on. On a Florida front, I'm still growing my garden, and I think that we'll maybe I'll put a little video up of it as it grows. It's starting to look like a garden as opposed to little tiny microscopic green things coming out of the dirt, so I'm getting excited about that. I also had the opportunity to speak this week at the Humane Society's Food Forward conference, and that was great fun. It was put on by Carla Dumas, my registered dietitian friend up in Sarasota, and the American Humane Society. And it was to educate people and institutions on Meatless Monday and Lean Green campaign. And, you know, again, the Humane Society is doing wonderful work to help institutions like universities. They started vegan restaurant, University of North Texas, Arizona State, Harvard. So many universities and schools are either having sections where they have vegan options or vegan canteens where they have little vegan restaurants. And it's becoming wildly popular at universities because, you know, young college students are starting to want to eat more healthy or have healthy options. And so even people that aren't vegan or plant-based are going for these options because they're so tasty. So more and more people are doing that. We also had presentations from some school districts that are doing Green Mondays, and in particular, the school district in Dade County, Miami, who I want to have the RD on from that school district. They're doing it from basically from garden to table education with their students where, you know, as little as kindergarten and first graders and grade school kids are growing food in the garden and then bringing it in and learning about it in the garden, learning about it, how you prepare it and eating. So, you know, it's such a great education because if kids start out eating healthy, they're going to eat healthy all their life. And they're also finding their test scores increase or improve. They're finding that, you know, they're educating their parents on, you know, I'd rather have these healthy foods than the junk food. So it's a win-win for everybody. And, you know, the American Humane Society is behind all of this. I presented on my nutrition class here in the office. And, you know, so it's, which has also been, you know, wildly successful in the, you know, older population. It was a great fun day. And I was very enthusiastic about the opportunities to work with, you know, other institutions to try to increase plant-based eating and plant-based options in restaurant setting. And we even talked about possibly going into some assisted living facilities and talking about having a Go Green Monday or a Meatless Monday there to help increase the food there. Because, as you know, you're never too old to benefit from eating a healthier diet. Today's interviewee is Dr. Paul Thompson, and it's a little bit off topic as far as nutrition, but I think it's relevant as far as being an endurance athlete, and I've had a couple questions regarding atrial fibrillation in the athlete. Dr. Thompson, I had the pleasure of working under him when I was a fellow in training at the University of Pittsburgh in the early 90s. He went from there to Tufts University and then ultimately to the University of Connecticut, where he is now chief of cardiology at Hartford Hospital. He's also the director of the Athlete Heart Program. He's the director of the cholesterol management program there. And today, Paul and I speak about atrial fibrillation in the athlete and what we know and what we don't know and what the future brings. So I'll let him, we'll go ahead and do the interview, and then I'll summarize and maybe go over a few things and a few points that he may have. But again, Dr. Thompson he's widely published. He has over 244 publications. If you subscribe to Runner's World, he's a frequent contributor there as well. So he's widely knowledgeable and as a cardiologist regarding atrial fibrillation in the athlete's heart. And he's also a very distinguished runner himself, 16th place in the Boston Marathon, avid runner until I guess last year when he had a cycle crash and broke his hip. So that sidelined him. So now he's more of a cyclist. But if you look him up, you'll see he's a very fit individual and certainly practices what he preaches. So I'm sure you'll enjoy this interview. Welcome, Dr. Paul Thompson. I had the pleasure of being a cardiology fellow under Dr. Thompson many, many years ago now, unfortunately. But at that time, you were at the University of Pittsburgh and an avid runner, and I couldn't figure out why anybody would want to run. And later on, I took up marathon running and, you know, continued my cardiology practice. And we do this plant-based podcast, and we talk endurance athletics and training. And, you know, it comes up every once in a while, you know, atrial fibrillation in endurance athletes. You know, they all, you know, people that don't do endurance sports say, you know, you're going to kill yourself with, you're going to kill your knees, you're going to, you know, you're going to hurt your heart, now you're going to get atrial fibrillation. So welcome, Paul, and let's have a chat about all this.
Well, great. Thanks for having me. So, you know, if I had to give you the skinny, I would say that atrial fibrillation, there's some good and there's some bad when it comes to exercise. So first of all, let's do the good. There's increasing amounts of evidence that people who get some exercise have a reduced risk of atrial fibrillation than people that don't. So let me stop for a minute. What the heck is atrial fibrillation? Well, the top of your heart is called the atria. And you know, like atria means kind of an entry room. So, or an open space. So the atria is the top of the heart. And what happens is that blood goes into the atria from the legs and from the upper body, or it goes into the atria from the lungs. So there's the right atria, so the blood comes from the head and it comes from the lower body. And then there's the left atrium, and the left atrium that gets the red blood that's coming back from the lungs. So these atria are supposed to just contract, you know, gush, the regular old squeezing of the heart. Now, what happens in atrial fibrillation is it becomes chaotic. Rather than there being a gush, the atria just quiver. They don't move. They don't push blood ahead. You can do quite well with this, but there's a problem. When blood's not moving along, it can form blood clots, and those blood clots can flip out of the left atrium, and they can give you a stroke. In fact, a large cause of strokes in individuals over the age of 80 or even over the age of 75 is not from narrowing of the blood vessels, but from atrial fibrillation that they never even knew they had and throws out a blood clot. So that's the background on atrial fibrillation. Now let's talk about the background on exercise. With exercise, as I mentioned, as you go from no exercise to doing some exercise, it looks like you get less atrial fibrillation. But the bad part of it is that after you get down to a certain low level, and we don't know exactly where that is, people who get a ton of exercise, people who have been like lifelong endurance athletes, actually seem to have more atrial fibrillation. Now, why do they have more atrial fibrillation? We really don't know. It may be because there are neurological changes that happen with exercise training. Now, what can those be? Well, when you exercise train, a lot of you notice that your heart rate gets slower. That's due to the increased activity of a nerve called the vagus, after the term vagrant, because it wanders all over the body. So the vagrant nerve, the vagus nerve, increased tone of the vagus nerve slows the heart. And by slowing the heart, it may also increase the risk of atrial fibrillation. Now, the other thing that happens is that when you exercise train, all of you or many of you know that your heart gets big. And one of the parts of the heart that gets big is the left atria and the right atrium, as well. The left atrium and the right atrium get bigger. And the bigger your atrium, the bigger the chance of having atrial fibrillation. So we talk about it as being a J-shaped curve. As you get more exercise, the risk goes down. As you get too much exercise, and we don't know where that bottom is, it looks like the risk tends to go up.
Most of these, you know, and it kind of makes sense. There's a lot of very small studies. And, you know, as we both know, as you get older, your risk of atrial fibrillation also increases.
It does. That's exactly right.
So, and another reason is people that have high blood pressure, their atria tends to increase. People that have valvular heart disease, their atrial size tends to increase. So if, you know, and then, you know, various other risk factors. Most of these studies that I seem to have looked at, they control for age and sometimes hypertension and sex. So males tend to have more age. Most of these studies looked only at males. And a few that looked at both, males tend to have a greater risk than females. Again, could be because of left atrial size.
Those are all excellent points. So we don't know the answer to those questions, but they're good questions. So first of all, men tend to have more atrial fibrillation, at least among male athletes. And we don't know exactly why that is, but it may be that at the present time, there aren't a lot of women who have been doing it for 30 or 40 years. There will be in the future, but one possibility is simply the exposure to the length of the exercise training. The other thing is a very good point, and that's the size of the heart. Hearts tend to be bigger. in males. And the bigger your heart, the bigger the chance you're going to get this atrial fibrillation. So those are excellent points. Now, let me make sure that people understand clearly. We're not absolutely certain that the risk of atrial fibrillation goes up with lifelong training. There are a bunch of small studies, as you mentioned. We reported a summary of them in 2009, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But there are a bunch of small studies, but there are also now growing large studies. So let me tell you about one of them. One of the studies took people who had 52,000 people who had competed in the Vasaloppet cross-country ski race in Sweden. And what they found is that among those people who participated in the Vasaloppet, and I think it's 56 miles or something like that, those people that had done the most races tend to have the most incidence of atrial fibrillation. Those people who had done the races the fastest tend to have an increased risk of atrial fibrillation. So it seems to be associated with both how many races you did and how good you were, believe it or not. So, it just does look like this is an issue with athletes. Now, I take care of athletes with heart disease. That's one of the things I do, because I have this interest. I've had a lifelong interest in competitive distance running. You know, next week I'll see a guy from Tennessee coming all the way to Hartford because he's got atrial fibrillation and he's an athlete. We see people from all over the country. It is incredibly common. I know so many very good athletes, lifelong athletes, who now have atrial fibrillation. Is it the exercise? We think so. Can't prove it. Is it getting older? Yeah, everybody would agree that getting older has a real contributing factor.
When you're looking at these people, one of the things that bother me as, I'm participating in some of these events is, because of the popularity of the Rock and Roll series and a bunch of these series, there's more couch to marathoners and couch to Ironman athletes. So a lot of them present with, they're still in their 40s, but as we know, cardiovascular disease starts probably in your 30s on a standard American diet. So, I often wonder what role does, you take these? And of course, you pointed out that the better you are and the longer you've done it seems to be the incidence. But, also might we worry about these people that are, maybe not in the best shape that go from 0 to 150?
Yeah, we're always a little concerned about the people that go from 0 to 150. But with respect to the atrial, but for other things, for sudden death during exercise and that sort of stuff, for the people with the atrial fibrillation that we're talking about, I'm really referring to people who are, more like me, for example, who've been, participated in competitive road racing since I was 12. So that's the group that's actually most vulnerable, we think, to develop atrial fibrillation. Now, the atrial fibrillation goes up with obesity. Atrial fibrillation goes up with high blood pressure, which goes up with obesity, etc. So that person who's starting exercise and is not in very good shape, they're at risk for atrial fibrillation. But we don't think from the exercise as much as we think from the hypertension and the obesity. So we're talking about really two different things. In fact, the atrial fibrillation in the athletes, I view it as somewhat paradoxical, because we think of people getting in shape as having less atrial fibrillation. That's the decreasing part of that J-shaped or U-shaped curve. And then the surprise to me was when we started seeing all these older athletes who had taken care of themselves for a long time presenting with atrial fibrillation. That's what I consider almost paradoxical.
What do you think about, training methods? You have the long, slow training, 80-20 type training methods where most of the stuff is done slow, and then you have, tempo runs and other things like that, versus there are some training programs that are now becoming popular where people do maybe 2 or 3 sessions a week but push really hard. Is there any recommendation, especially in an older athlete or somebody that's been training for a while, that maybe they shouldn't push as hard as often?
So, no, I wouldn't get into that, because we don't know, with respect to atrial fibrillation, we don't know whether there's any sort of regimen that's more likely to bring it on. So I really can't give you a strong recommendations along those lines. From having been competitive over the years, we're all different. So some of us can do 12 hard days and then need a day off, whereas some people can do 2 hard days and need a day that's really backing off. Like, my rule was always very simple. I was never very sophisticated. And the simple rule was that if you want to run run fast, you got to train fast, and if you want to run long, you got to train long. If you want to run fast and long, you better do some fast training and some long training. That's about the extent of my sophisticated training.
Cool. And now, are you more of a cyclist now?
Well, see, I broke my hip in a bicycle accident, actually on the Boston Marathon course in 2012. So I'm now a cyclist, primarily. I cycle to work. But, you know, I was going to say that I'm a competitive drinker. But that's not funny. So let me tell you why it's not funny. Because alcohol increases atrial fibrillation. In fact, you see some athletes who come in, and they have a fair amount of atrial fibrillation, but they also, bend the elbow a fair amount. So one of the things for athletes who do have atrial fibrillation is at least think about how much alcohol you're taking. In Boston, when I worked at Tufts New England Medical Center, we used to call it holiday heart during St. Patrick's Day. You know, people would get a holiday heart because they would go out and they would drink a lot, and they would come into the emergency room with atrial fibrillation. So, yes, a long answer to a question. I'm a cyclist rather than a runner now.
Okay, it sounds good.
But let me tell you, I miss this. For me, there was never anything quite like running. I think I was born to run.
Yeah, it's nothing. Nothing can take the stress quite as good. And you don't have to worry about pumping up your tires and all the other kind of stuff associated with
or getting hit as by a car. Everybody says that a bicyclist is basically an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're seeing, obviously then you see a fair amount of these athletes, what kind of recommendations do you make to them besides don't bend your elbow quite as much? Do you have a
So what you recommend to athletes who come in with atrial fibrillation depends on how frequently they're getting it. So some people get it very intermittently. So what are the things that we worry about with atrial fibrillation? We worry about that somebody's going to get a blood clot, and we also worry about the fact that they're going to be stuck in atrial fibrillation. So there's one approach that you can do. It's called the pill-in-the-pocket approach. So what you do is when a person comes in with atrial fibrillation, they're one of several medicines that we can give them, and they can take it. And oftentimes, that will convert their rhythm back to the normal rhythm. So I often say to these runner patients, look, if it's not back to the normal rhythm in an hour, take, these two pills. And the nice thing is that there are now these very rapidly onsetting blood thinners. So if somebody goes into atrial fibrillation, I can give them pills to pop them out of it, and I can give them something to thin their blood, and you can do those things simultaneously. And many of the runners, when they start, can convert normally. Then if people are having longer episodes of atrial fibrillation, we can put them on other medicines that helps keep them in normal sinus rhythm. Now, there's also a very neat procedure that I do that I recommend gets done with a lot of runners. You can take and go into the heart with these catheters that have they have radio frequency. It's called radio frequency ablation. So these catheters put a little burn mark, so more or less, in the atria around certain places that we know these atrial fibrillation waves start. So a lot of runners that I have who are bothered by atrial fibrillation, we actually move fairly quickly from the medicines, if they don't work, to doing what's called an atrial fibrillation ablation procedure. And we simply recommend that those be done by people who do a lot of them.
Do you find that there's any – so if somebody has an ablation – I saw just briefly, and I didn't read them at this point, but you have a risk of if you're flutter and you get ablated, then you might have a slighter increased risk of AFib, or you're not seeing that?
That's true. Yeah. That's true. So there are two types of atrial rhythms. The one we're talking about right now is something called atrial fibrillation. There's another one called atrial flutter. And atrial flutter is very easily treated with ablation. So it's something we do a lot. Frequently, but some people with atrial flutter will go on and develop the more difficult to manage atrial fibrillation. So sometimes the flutter ablation leads to needing an atrial fibrillation ablation later on. It's very hard to kind of give definitive recommendations for all the conditions without actually seeing the patient. So that's why I always say that some computer is probably not going to replace me in the near future, because there's nothing like seeing the patient, seeing the runner, seeing the athlete, seeing what they want to do, seeing what the things are that make them nervous, seeing what they're willing to tolerate, and then making the decisions on an individual basis.
Do you worry about the triathlete with atrial fibrillation and anticoagulation, or just put your helmet on tight?
So I always worry about the athlete or anybody who's on long-term anticoagulation, because, you know, especially, you know, bicyclists who are not triathletes, but bicyclists who draft and ride in pelotons and stuff like that. So the goal is to get the person, if you can, on the lowest dose of atrial fibrillation, or to get them into sports in which they're safe. So I'm at the lowest doses of anticoagulation, or into sports where they're safe. I always worry. So the issue is this, for those of you who don't know, is that if you're on a blood thinner, you're on anticoagulation, you're on a blood thinner, and you have an accident, you're clearly going to bleed more than somebody who doesn't. The other thing is that if you have a bike crash and you hit your head, that's quite dangerous. So again, that's the whole issue of discussing with the patients how risky they are to have a stroke versus how risky they are to get a bleed from being on anticoagulation. And it's not always an easy decision.
Do you see the future of these clamshell-type devices for the left atrial appendage as helping us out a little bit?
So what you're talking about is that there's these new devices. They're not kind of they're a little bit like a clamshell. You take and put them, it's called the Watchman device. And the Watchman device can go into the area of the left atrium where most of the blood clots come from. It's called the left atrial appendage. So you go in there and you occlude the left atrial appendage. And what's nice about this is that after 3 months of anticoagulation, after 3 months of the blood thinner, you no longer, we think, need the blood thinner. This has just been approved and just released, and, you know, I don't have a lot of experience with it. So it's something that's going to be available in the future. What its exact role is for my patients, I haven't yet figured out, so I don't have strong feelings one way or the other. I'm not always the person that takes the newest. I'm not always a physician who takes the newest device and thinks it's going to be, the be all and end all. I like to see what happens a little bit in the marketplace before I proceed.
I must have learned that from my training at the University of Pittsburgh. I'd much rather watch what happens to other people before I start to prescribe it to my patients.
Yeah, that's right.
So good. I do appreciate you taking time to kind of sorting that out. You know, we all like, you know, and as you know, endurance junkies, you know, we want to think that we're the healthiest people on the planet, but everybody is a little bit vulnerable and has to pay attention.
Yeah, everybody's a little bit vulnerable. I always say that nobody gets out alive. So we just, you know, and the things as they come along can be handled. And so the thing is to, you know, make sure you get good advice. Make sure you consider your options. I always make sure that people don't feel as if something's being forced down their throat. We have lots of ways to deal with things at the present time. And, you know, for people out there, whatever your physician tells you, make sure you understand the pros and cons of both sides, because there are lots of ways to treat atrial fibrillation. There are a lot of ways to take care of athletes. I never used to think it was important to be involved with a physician that that knew about a fair amount about athletics, but I've changed my mind on that over the years. And the reason I've changed my mind is that somebody that knows what certain times are and things like that. I mean, I can often judge when somebody is really not doing well simply by their swimming times or by their mile time, whereas I think somebody that's not so conversant with the sports or the sport has more difficulty doing that.
Do you find in your athletes, I mean, can they tell pretty much when they're flipping in and out of atrial fibrillation? It just depends, like everybody else.
I think a lot of athletes can more than other people, and especially if it happens when they're performing or they're exercising, because your cardiac output they don't feel as good, so they're not pushing out as much blood, their cardiac output, it causes them to be more short of breath and stuff, and it interferes with their performance. So yeah, I think they're more aware now. I don't want to go too far with that, because a lot of atrial fibrillation is silent. It kind of sneaks up on you. So what I tell people is that if you have a lot of extra beats, you think you've got palpitations, make sure you get it checked out, because as you get older, there's an increasing risk or chance that that could be atrial fibrillation. And if it's atrial fibrillation, it probably ought to be dealt with. There is risk of throwing a blood clot, even if you're not in permanent atrial fibrillation. Even if you go in and out rarely, there's a risk of throwing a blood clot. So if you have a lot of palpitations, you ought to get it checked out with somebody that is familiar with atrial fibrillation.
So, you know, these guys that have maybe a couple, two or three episodes a year, you still anticoagulate them?
Depends. There's a score that we can give people. It's called the CHAD score, the CHAD SAS score. There's a score we can give people that gives their risk of having a blood clot fly out, a stroke. And so, I use the CHAD score. And a lot of runners, luckily, don't have a very high risk, so I don't anticoagulate them. There are a lot of people that will anticoagulate only when they have symptoms, because with these new drugs, you know, you can be anticoagulated within 2 hours. It's not like the old Coumadin, where you had to wait 3 to 5 days for them to be anticoagulated. So I have some patients that go in and out, and when they tell me they're in, I tell them to just take their medicine until it goes away.
You don't try to keep them on for like 6 weeks or anything? You just
No, not usually. Nothing. In other words, I'll keep them on for a little time past the time that they convert. Now, the reason you bring that up is a very good point, and I probably should make it. If a person's been in atrial fibrillation for any period of time, when they come out of the abnormal rhythm, when they come out of the atrial fibrillation, the heart doesn't start to contract normally for up to 9 or so days after they get to the normal rhythm. So if you're in atrial fibrillation and you're put on a blood thinner, you want to talk to your doctor about how long after the atrial fibrillation stops you should be on the blood thinner.
Very good, very good. Well, that's been, you know, very informative, and I think probably calms a lot of people down, and maybe probably ask some questions anyway, or maybe poses some questions to people as far as, you know, what they should do. But like you say, nobody gets out of this alive, so you enjoy what you want to enjoy what you enjoy while you can, and be conscious of what's going on.
Yeah, and I think it's a very important message for your audience to know that you really shouldn't be worried about things, because most of these things we can take care of. Medicine can take care of. You know, you should be concerned, but not necessarily worried, because, you know, it's just amazing, and it gets better every year, what we're able to do, and, you know, we're very lucky that we have these medications and stuff. You know, when I trained, I finished my training in 1978. We did not know for sure that blood-thinning people with atrial fibrillation saves strokes, prevented strokes. We know so much more than we did, and every year we know more. So don't worry. See somebody, and you have your problems evaluated, and things frequently work out for the better.
Do you think there's any role for an echo in people that are, you know, say you got a 50-year-old that's going to do their first Ironman to measure atrial size? I mean,
no, I don't really. I think you could find a big left atrium. That may mean that you're going to get atrial fibrillation, but until you get atrial fibrillation, it doesn't mean anything. So, you know, I've always had a gigantic left atrium, and, you know, that's just the way it is, despite being a small person. So, no, I don't think – I've never been a big fan of a lot of extra testing if you're feeling okay. And the reason I'm not a big fan is, what do? You find problems. You find problems which may or may not have resulted in a serious problem later on. So I've never been a big fan of screening. I think it's a great way to drive business in medicine, but I don't think it's necessarily a great way to save lives.
I agree, and I'm probably not going to echo myself this afternoon.
Oh, go ahead. It's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I must admit to having gotten an echo because I wanted to see how big my heart was, but that was way back in 1976, and that was the year I was 16th in Boston, so I wanted to see how big my heart was. But I wouldn't do it routinely anymore.
That sounds good. I think, the last time I echoed myself, I was checking on to see which way my daughter was pointed, so.
That's a good thing. You know, this is an interesting story. I had twin daughters born in, let me see, 1974. And so you didn't routinely echo people at that time. So we actually took and did an echo on my wife, and we have these two circles. That's all you can see, because you couldn't see anything more. The echo machines were so poor. So you can just see these two circles, and that's how we realized we were having twins.
Very, very good. Well, I am so glad to reconnect with you. Every time I see your name in Runner's World, I was like, I know that guy. And, brings back good memories at the University of Pittsburgh. The last funny story that I'll recant, I gave a talk this week at a conference, and a young registered dietitian asked me about nutrition during endurance athletes, and she says, well, you may not be the same in you being much older and probably with a lower metabolism. And it's like, well, I guess it's official, I'm old now. So,
well, I tell people they're not old until Willard Scott reads their name on the Today Show.
There you go.
And when I say to patients, how young are you? And some of them will say, you know, what do you mean, how old I am? And I'll say, you know, you what? You have a bad attitude.
I just refer to it as the number on my calf, and that's all there is to it. And hopefully the age group gets smaller, and I have a better chance of being number one. So that's all that.
Good luck to you.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks
for
having me.
All right. Have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Thompson. It was certainly enlightening, and I think he clarified a lot of things. Maybe just to go over a few things, we know that the longer and harder that you've been an endurance athlete probably increases your risk of developing atrial fibrillation. And it's kind of like a J point. So a certain amount of exercise is going to decrease your risk. And then after that point, it probably increases. But we don't quite know when that is and how that's associated with each individual's. We also know that if you have a smaller heart, you're less likely than a bigger heart to get atrial fibrillation. And that women are less likely than men. But as he pointed out, it may be that men haven't, or women haven't been studied as long, and they haven't noticed, you know, lifelong in women endurance athletes. So some of our marathon runners that are up and coming, as they get older, we may see more atrial fibrillation in them. The CHAD score that he was speaking to is a point system, and two or more points, you definitely want to get anticoagulated, a blood thinner, to prevent the risk of stroke. And the risk factors are heart failure, hypertension greater than 75, diabetes, or a history of stroke. That's 2 points. They're the ones for one. So, you know, if you have a very low CHAD score, less than 2, then maybe you don't need anticoagulation. I also, you know, think that it's very encouraging, as Dr. Thompson reiterated, that, you know, there's more and more things we can do about it as people develop atrial fibrillation, as far as different medications that are more effective, blood thinners that can protect you right away, and then some upcoming devices and procedures that may ultimately be able to get rid of atrial fibrillation and decrease, and maybe in the future, hopefully eliminate the need for anticoagulation. So, you know, are there recommendations out there to prevent it? Well, not really. If you're a lifelong collegiate runner that are still running marathons, you know, some people will and some people won't. I do think that, again, the other risk factors for atrial fibrillation in the population are, as we get older, if you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obesity, and diabetes. So those are things that you definitely want to avoid. And luckily for hopefully most of those people listening to this program, or after they finish, that plant-based nutrition decreases the risk for other lifestyle diseases such as hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, that will increase your risk for atrial fibrillation. So it's more of a reason to be, you know, to become plant-based. There may be more reasons to find in the future. As far as, you know, we know that vascular reactivity may have something to do with ultimate change in pressures that may slowly increase chamber size. So by eating plant-based, you know, we may have even more of an advantage. So again, I think it's, you know, very important to continue a whole food, plant-based, no added oil diet to keep your risk down and keep you exercising and doing the activities that you want for as long as you possibly can. On that note, I just wanted to share a patient that was all enthusiastic about becoming plant-based and eliminating the need for statin therapy. And 8 weeks later, she got her blood drawn, and really there wasn't any change, and she was very disappointed, and she couldn't understand why she didn't have a drop in her cholesterol. So we brought her in to talk with her, and just went over, you know, what did you have to eat yesterday? And it turns out that there were crackers for breakfast with, some jam, so no fiber. She had oil on her salad at lunch. She had baked fish with breadcrumbs and oil spray for dinner, and cookies that a coworker brought. She often notes, you know, eating breads that are store-bought breads, you know, that have added oil, things that she really didn't realize. So those of you having trouble lowering your cholesterol, you have to really keep a food diary to just notice what kind of oil you're getting into, because it is in so many things and it's very difficult. And the more you focus on eating whole foods like they came out of the garden, the better chance that you'll have of lowering your cholesterol. You know, on the converse side, I had someone lower their cholesterol about 60 points in less than 2 months. And, you know, again, it was more of a whole foods, plant-based diet. So there's ways to tweak it. So don't be discouraged if your numbers don't go down right at first, because it is a learning curve. And I think that's why the nutrition class is so important, because it teaches you how to watch out for those things that may cause, that may have hidden oils that cause you not to get the results that you were looking for. I also had a person in my class that, you know, again, we looked at the fiber content this week five of my 6 week class, and looked at the fiber that the class was getting with the meal that they had the day before the class. So it was a random question, and it varied from 9 grams of fiber to I think about 23 or 24 grams of fiber. So it just goes to show you that we can all use more fiber in our diet, you know, through vegetables. Whole vegetables, whole fruits, and whole grains, and skip and decreasing the processed food. So, you know, eat those 4 servings of greens, eat the beans, eat the fruit to increase your fiber, because by increasing your fiber, you're going to increase being full, and you're going to decrease your cholesterol that way, and you're going to crowd out those things with no fiber that aren't of any benefit for you. So I think that we'll probably wrap it up for this week. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Dr. Thompson. If you have any questions, you can email me at jamiedelaney at gmail.com. It's J-A-M-I. Dr. Delaney, D-O-C-T-O-R, Delaney, D-U-L-A-N-E-Y, .com for my website. We'll be starting our next nutrition course December the 7th. And again, that's our 6 week courses every other Wednesday for an hour, where I do cooking demonstrations. We're also going to have, and I'll give the details in the next couple of months, but we're going to try to do a day long conference here in Port Charlotte, Florida, with some various speakers and cooking demonstrations. And I think we're going to try to shoot for January 23rd. So I'll keep you informed as that materializes, and hopefully it will. So until next time, eat your vegetables. Eat high fiber, watch out for hidden oils, and get your exercise, and don't be afraid.